Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Metaphysical Hour. And tonight is March 18th, 2016, and I'm Julia Cannon, and alongside Shonda Garrison, brain goes out. It's so funny how that happens. I was talking perfectly lucid 1 minute and gone the next. Okay, and here we are because we're live. Okay. All is good. I'll just get into my track here. Okay. Anyway, we were talking about that earlier. Did anybody else have a strange night last night? Well, I'll ask you here in a minute, David. Something strange was going on last night, I think. Anyway, let me give out this toll-free number. And if anybody wants to call in with questions for our guest tonight, and we'll go into what that's about. But our toll-free number, because apparently we didn't give that out last week. I really don't remember. That's weird. Okay. But our toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. And as everybody, if you don't know, we have our conferences coming up. We're really, really excited about, and because we're doing it a little different this year. We normally have our conferences, the Transformation Conference and the UFO Conference, sitting about 2 months apart.
Yeah.
And they, you know, one conference a year is a lot of work. Two conferences a year, 2 months apart, is an enormous amount of work. And so we thought, well, how about, you know, let's put them together and see if that doesn't help a little bit. So that's what we've done this year. And so that's why we've done it, actually. And it's just, it's helping on this end. I hope it's helping on everybody else's end to make an even bigger, better experience. I feel like it would be, you know, I mean, my goodness, look what they get to come to. Oh my man. Shoot.
A week full of info.
Man, oh my, you know, mind blowing. I mean, you get to go from mega, mega spiritual and mind blowing there to mega, mega UFO and mind blowing there. And oh my goodness, you just get the whole blast, but you end up with 22 speakers. Wow.
And you get to see all of them.
Yeah.
You don't have to pick and choose.
No, you get to see everybody. And you get workshops in there too, if you want them. And then you get vendors and with all kinds of things. And some of them are changing out between the two events. And so they're not the same all the time. And my goodness, this is just fantastic. You know, and in the beautiful city of Eureka Springs, Arkansas. I mean, can it be any better? I don't think so. Just ask me.
Do you think so?
I don't think so. I think it's just absolutely fantastic. and I think that's why Lou put it there in the very first place, you know?
Yeah.
You know, 29 years ago, the UFO conference, when it very began, 1988, because it's such a gorgeous place and the best place to have something like that.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever been there, for those who haven't been there, that is a perfect place to put something. I mean, it's just, one, it's very metaphysical in feeling, but it also, I mean, if you were an extraterrestrial, wouldn't you go there? We'll get you to talk here in a minute. Okay. Anyway, it is a gorgeous place. It's beautiful. It's very down to earth and natural. Mm-hmm. And, we have some, there's strange people here and everywhere, but it's very natural and it's just a gorgeous place.
In spring, it just gets even more gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, it just draws people, from everywhere. And what I love about this event now, is because it's been here for so long, it's like family members coming. Now everybody keeps coming back, and this to both events now, actually, it's people just keep coming back over and over and over.
Oh yeah. And it's so great to see those faces.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Well, bodies.
Yeah, and even the speakers. That's what they say. They keep coming back just to see each other again.
Oh yeah.
And so it's just wonderful. So anyway, I don't want to take any more time, you know, from our wonderful guest tonight. So I think everyone else is probably saying, "Will you get on with it? Will you let David talk?" My goodness. Goodness. I'll hear about it later. I know. our wonderful guest tonight, I'm so excited to have you, David, is David Marler. And he's going to be one of our speakers at the UFO conference. I'm so excited to have you, David.
Well,
so welcome
you.
Aboard.
It's a pleasure to be here and to be invited to the conference. To kind of echo your earlier statements, I had been a regular attendee of the conference going back to the early 90s, and of course knew Lou Farish very well, and am happy to say, and I'll make a special announcement here for the show, but I was also going to make it at the conference, that when Lou passed away, he bequeathed his entire UFO research library to me, which I incorporated into my already large existing library. And I have something I'll mention towards the end of the show. There's a little teaser to keep people staying tuned that I'd like to mention. I was going to save it for the conference, but I think it's important since you talked about the conference in such positive terms, which it is one of the most enjoyable conferences. I've heard that consistently year after year from attendees, as well as you mentioned, Julia, lecturers. I've heard that through the circuit over the years that people just love Eureka Springs, but obviously, Lou is a big part of that, getting that going initially. And then, of course, the tradition continued. But, you know, I have something towards the end, which I'll mention. Be sure to remind me regarding Lou's research library that I'd like to share with the audience.
Yes, yes. Wonderful. That is so fascinating, you know, that happened. So, yes, absolutely. You must talk about that. So what I'd like to start with, though, is how... Let's hear a little bit about your journey and what on earth got you into this whole weird world of UFOs.
What on earth or off earth got me interested in the subject might be a better way of putting it.
There you go.
My interest started, believe it or not, at the early age of 5 years old. It was 1973. I was living at that time where I was pretty much born and raised in the area of St. Louis, Missouri. I lived on the Illinois side of the river. And in 1973, there was an unprecedented wave of UFO sightings and activity. And many of your listeners may be familiar with this period. It centered primarily around the small city of Piedmont, Missouri. And this was actually the impetus for a book that was written by Dr. Harley Rutledge, who was the physics professor at Southeast Missouri State University. And for a number of weeks and months, they had UFO sightings, nocturnal lights and other objects being seen in addition to lights in the sky. And for those weeks and months, his colleagues at the university kept prodding him, saying, "Well, you're a physics professor. You should go down there and try to debunk or explain what's going on down there." And in a number of interviews, which I have in my research library, interviews from 1973, 74, he stated matter-of-factly, and his son in later years told me, that he often used to say, "I wouldn't touch that UFO subject with a 10-foot pole." But the reports continued to pour in. And reports, as we all know, this is a typical pattern from your average citizen to your mayor, to your police officers, to your teachers. Every walk of life, people were reporting these things. And so eventually Dr. Rutledge went down there essentially to debunk, to find a plausible scientific explanation for this mystery. And not to use the term, because he would probably hate me if I use this, but he became, for lack of a better term, a UFO believer. that there was a genuine phenomenon that deserved better scrutiny. And I would tend to agree with that. I think that's where we're at today. We're still trying to find answers, but there does appear to be a genuine phenomenon here. And what started my personal interest, though, was one of the very first adult witnesses that observed the UFOs on the first night was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Reggie Bone. And Reggie was a childhood friend of my father growing up. My father was originally from that area. And I remember at 5 years old, my father's interest in UFOs. He was never an active investigator, but would read everything on the subject he could get his hands on. I remember at 5 years old, him making a comment that if Reggie said he saw something, he saw something. He was the basketball coach. He was a pillar of the community. Everyone in that city at that time would attest that Reggie was about as no-nonsense as you could get. And if you don't want to believe that, on the night of his sighting, he was actually not alone. He was driving the basketball team back from a game that they had just lost. So he, two or three other adults, and half the basketball team observed this UFO. They first saw it in their van while they were driving. They later pulled over and they saw this object, this unidentified flying object, hovering over a field. It appeared to be slowly settling down, had an array of lights around it, and then all of a sudden, silently and quickly, it just shot off at an oblique angle and disappeared in the sky. And this was, as we all know, the beginning of what turned out to be a wave of sightings in that area for a number of years. And recently, I was speaking with some Missouri MUFON people, and they had suggested to me that apparently there's still activity going on there. But I heard about that. That was the first time I was introduced to the term UFO. And the one thing that resonated with me, being 5 years old, as I wrote in my book, I was tasked with the job of staying home with my mother, who had as much in the way of disinterest in the UFO subject as my father had an interest. But I remember my father, my older brothers, and my older sister piling in the car and making the 2.5-3 hour drive down to Piedmont on weekends to, quote unquote, look for UFOs. And I just remember the excitement when they would leave, and more importantly, the stories that they would come back with. They themselves never observed anything, but the stories from credible individuals that had apparently seen these things, they would come back and they would relay these stories. And being an impressionable 5-year-old child, it just captivated my interest. And that was in 73. And then jumping forward 4 years, in 77, my sister and her husband had a, for lack of a better term, close encounter with a UFO that was very dramatic. It shook them up emotionally. And that was in 77. And of course, I heard about that. We talked about that story when we'd get together for family functions in the subsequent years. And then in 1 year later in 1978, just like Piedmont, there was a wave of UFO sightings and cattle mutilations in this instance surrounding the area of Ellsbury, Missouri, which is just north of the greater St. Louis metropolitan area. And that had garnered a lot of local television news interest as well as newspaper interest, much like Piedmont had done back in 1973. So it was really those three things during the early course of my life, from roughly age 5 to age 10, where my interest really continued to, you know, be piqued and intensified the more I heard about these stories. And then in 1990, jumping forward, was the first time I had heard about MUFON and joined MUFON, started as a field investigator trainee, slowly worked my way up and eventually became Illinois State Director for several years and conducted numerous investigations, worked with my field investigators, state section directors, began lecturing on the subject, and over that period of time began to collect all of this historical UFO material, which I've now amassed into a huge library, which I make accessible to researchers and other interested parties.
My goodness. Now, have you yourself seen anything? I mean, have you had any sightings?
Nothing significant. I mean, I've seen little points of light in the sky that made unusual maneuvers. But as I've often told people, for David Marler to say he saw a genuine UFO, I need to see rivets. I need to see seams on the object. I need to see a detailed structured object. I can rationalize little points of light And that's interesting, too, that you bring that up, because I was just having a conversation with a reporter from the Huffington Post the other day, and I've been quoted several times. Apparently, this term is catching on. I've been quoted several times making a distinction between the triangular UFOs, which I wrote my book on, and these ambiguous points of light in the sky. And a lot of UFO researchers and investigators over the years have told me we should really focus and muster our research efforts on ignoring the lights in the sky and focus on the more detailed reports. Because admittedly, some of these reports of lights in the sky are somewhat ambiguous. It could have been a star, could have been a meteor, could have been, you know, any number of things, depending on the nature of the sighting. But I often make the distinction that when you deal with these large triangular objects, which of course your listeners are probably familiar with the typical reports, these things that are estimated to be anywhere between 100 on a conservative level all the way up to 300 feet long and solid black, typically flying relatively low altitude, I like to make the distinction that those are what I like to consider unambiguous UFO sightings. It's not a matter of, did I see something? It's more of a matter of, I saw something, but what is it?
Right, right. So, okay. Now, all those sightings in the Missouri area, did they, in specific areas, have they gotten any closer to figuring out why in specific areas?
You know, that is like the $64,000 question, isn't it, with the UFO subject? You know, you can look at Ellsbury in 78. You can look at Piedmont in 73. In my book, I talk about the Hudson Valley wave that roughly ran from 83 to 89. We have the Belgian wave from 89 to 91. You have this history of, you know, periods of boredom punctuated with drama when these UFOs suddenly appear and tend to congregate over a general area. But there's different researchers that have looked at that. And from what I can gather, no one has really found a consistent correlation with either, you know, location, geology. I know some researchers have looked at fault lines as a potential correlation. A researcher friend of mine, he's looked at that. But I don't know if it's been definitively shown where there's a direct correlation between the two. And of course, even if there's correlation, it doesn't necessarily imply causation. It just simply means that there's a relationship there. Then it raises the question, okay, what relationship? But the researchers I've talked to and communicated with worldwide, I mean, that's one of the biggest questions that we have. And to compound things, as most of your listeners know, there's stories of different objects, different alien types. And so we're, I think sometimes, and I'm guilty of it more than anybody probably, trying to take all of the data and put it into one nice little puzzle box. And we may be dealing with 12 different puzzles, but we're trying to make one coherent picture out of all of it. And I think we're dealing with a much greater, far complex mystery and highly detailed mystery. And, you know, we always try to find the one answer or the one explanation. And I think we're dealing with something that is so complex.
Yeah, I was going to say, it may not be that simple. Yeah. Just, I was like, yeah, I was wondering, like, what, just exactly how, where are you on that line yet? You
know, exactly. And something to echo back to in your introductory comments regarding the conference, I think it's really nice that you have both conferences back to back, because getting back to what I was just saying, I think there's overlap in all of these subjects. We tend to create boxes and label things, but chances are we're probably dealing, and it's sheer speculation. I'll preface this by saying it's sheer speculation on my part. I think all of this stuff falls on a continuum, and there aren't discrete lines that divide them. They're probably more dotted lines that divide them. And there's actually overlap between these various phenomena.
Actually, you're very right. In the work that my mother was doing, that's what she was finding. And
right.
Do you remember John Mack?
I do.
Were you with him? And that's what he said. You're never really going to fully understand the extraterrestrials and all this world unless you understand metaphysics. And it's like, the two do overlay. And so, and that I was really excited when I started seeing the UFO world starting to become a little more spiritual. So it was like, you know, and it was like we still kind of had to keep them separate in a sense, but maybe if we kind of butt them up against each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I have to mention, I had the pleasure of meeting and listening to John Mack live as a result of going to one of the Ozark UFO conferences.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. So, yeah. And that's, it just takes a, you know, it just takes a while, but that's exactly what Mom got in her material was, you know, it's all spiritual. You know, and that's where her material was coming from. It was, you know, she was like, it's very high spiritual stuff.
And I've always erred on the more nuts and bolts side, but, and I think we need to have areas of focus in all of these areas. I think people need to focus on the metaphysical, the nuts and bolts, as long as we're willing to concede that this phenomenon may fall out of the parameters of our particular scope of research. You know, at least acknowledge those possibilities are there, and I certainly do.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's I agree, and that way just to open the box.
Interesting. You know, we're talking within the realm of the paranormal. Let's talk within the realm of the normal. For any of the listeners that watch the Discovery Channel or the Science Channel, look where mainstream physics is now going. They are starting to entertain possibilities that I remember reading books that were published back in the mid late 60s, and skeptics used to point to that, where we were talking at that time, and I say we collectively as UFO researchers back then, were beginning to think outside the realm of the traditional extraterrestrial hypothesis, whereby these entities or things are coming from planet A to planet B. They began to really start looking in the 60s and into the 70s that, well, maybe we're dealing with other dimensions of reality. Maybe we're dealing with parallel universes. And you can look back at the literature. Skeptics at the time would point to that and say, look at the folly of these UFO researchers. They're off in Never Never Land. I dare the listener to turn on the television now to the Smithsonian Channel or Science Channel and watch TV for an evening or two. And you're going to hear Michio Kaku or one of these other physicists out there talking about that very thing. Science is taking these people kicking and screaming into the 21st century now and exploring these possibilities that were otherwise laughed off.
Yeah, and, you know, we just didn't have the concepts in our minds to be able to grasp. We just couldn't grasp those concepts then, but we can now.
And it's so funny. All we have to do is look back at history as a teacher, and you look at science. How many times did science say, "No, that can't be," and then 10, 15 years later, maybe 50 years later, it became reality. In fact, in my UFO library, I have a lot of historic newspaper articles from the late 40s into the 50s, and of course, all the way up to modern times. But there were some articles written by some science experts at the time that were dismissing the thought of any type of lunar mission. And these were written in as late as, I believe, 58, 59. And they said and speculated it would be 20 to 40 years before we would land a man on the moon. Well, you know, basically, you know, following JFK's commitment to landing a man on the moon, we did it within, you know, 10 years' time. So,
right.
You know, science so often says this can't be or this will not happen. And then reality has a way of, you know, offering up some humble pie to these individuals that are skeptical.
Absolutely.
So I think we have to concede that the UFO subject, the area of metaphysics, is the same thing. You know, we may be scoffed. We may be laughed at. The skeptics may point fingers at us, you know, say derogatory things. But I think at the end of the day or end of the new millennium, I think time will prove that in many cases we were right, and that, you know, this is simply not imaginary. This is not fantasy. I worked with the Smithsonian Channel on a recent documentary series, and, you know, in reference to the triangular UFO research, I said that, you know, these things are not hallucinatory. You know, they're not aberrations due to atmospheric conditions. These things appear to be a real, tangible, solid phenomenon that we need to investigate.
And what do you think about them?
About
the triangle,
the origin, the nature?
Again,
I mean, pure speculation on my part. I always like to preface that. I'll talk facts at one point, but I always preface my speculation. I think we're dealing with multiple things. I don't think there is one answer. People have often asked me during my lectures, well, do you believe these things are from outer space? Do you believe they're time travelers? Do you believe they're from another dimension? And my answer sometimes is, might be, you know, D, all the above.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, but my goal, though, is to try to really find credible, documented materials, sorting through, you know, separating the wheat from the chaff and finding the more credible cases. And in my book on triangular UFOs, I thought that this was a very interesting subset of the UFO reports, and one that had been discussed for, you know, roughly 20, 25 years. But no serious book or, you know, examination had been done. There had been articles, certainly articles on the internet. There's videos, there's photographs. There's well-written documentation on the part of SOBEPS, the Belgian UFO research group, which I'm happy to say I've been in contact with Patrick Farron, who is the head of SOBEPS. He was actually here in Albuquerque over the summer, and we had a chance to spend a few days together and compare notes. And that was very enjoyable to be able to have him here and be able to ask him firsthand questions about the famous Belgian wave. And he, ironically enough, he had as much questions for me regarding my book and some of my historical cases that I uncovered. But I felt like there needed to be more serious attention. And not only that, as I've often said, I can't make a scientific argument for the reality of these things, namely because I don't have physical evidence, something that you can hold, something that you can measure. But what I decided to do was, based on the amount of historical data I had gathered, not make a scientific argument, but make a historical argument. Namely, look at the reports today, look at the reports back in the 80s when people were saying this is just all stealth, people are seeing B-2s, then take it back, as I did, using, in some cases, the government military's own files, going through Project Blue Book, finding cases that describe triangular UFOs, not just the shape, but the detailed flight dynamics that were being performed in modern reports that were being reported in the 50s and 60s through the Air Force Project Blue Book files. Then taking it even further and finding cases from the late 1880s describing this. One of the items I'll be bringing to the Ozark Conference, for anyone that's interested in seeing it, one of the oldest cases I referenced was in the 1880s, and it was reported by two amateur astronomers that saw these two triangular objects moving over the lunar surface through a telescope. And this was reported in Scientific American. After writing my book, I finally was able to find the original copy of Scientific American from the 1880s. And I like to bring that on lectures so people can actually hold that themselves and see that. You know, I go to the original source material whenever possible to verify that what I'm saying is accurate.
Mom, that's how Mom was.
Because a lot of people say things in this field, but at the end of the day, what do you have to back it up? And I try to back it up with at least as much historical material as I can. And in fact, that's really the support for my new book I'm working on, which is the Farmington, New Mexico Flying Saucer Armada, which I'll be talking about at the conference this year. And I've had a lot of interest on the part of researchers and other people that had seen some of the news segments that I had done here in Albuquerque recently on a recent lecture that I hosted. And I told the audience, and I will say the same thing to the audience in the Ozarks here in just a few weeks or so, that when you leave this room, you will know more about this famous case than anyone else. Because up until this point, if anyone does, any of your listeners decide to look this up on the internet, traditionally you will only find a quote from the Farmington Daily Times newspaper dated March 18th, 1950. That is the primary historical document that really captured the data, if you will, from that time period on this particular case. And ad infinitum, ad nauseum, you'll see the same quotes from the same newspaper on various websites. And when I was doing my initial research, I just thought to myself, well, there's got to be more information. And after moving here and after finishing my first book, I decided that I really would like to examine this Farmington case. There aren't many cases that we can say we had 3 full days of UFO sightings estimated in the hundreds that were seen by estimated thousands of eyewitnesses. I mean, you are very hard to find cases like that and cases that were documented at the time, which these were. And one of the things which I'll be sharing with the audience in the Ozarks, and this is something that has not been publicly released, are the research files of the late Dr. James McDonald, who is the atmospheric physicist at the University of Arizona in Tucson. In September, I had been given a tip by Stan Friedman when I told him I was working on this, and he said that Dr. James McDonald, before he died, was looking at that case along with a lot of other cases. So I took a trip down to Tucson, spent the entire day working with the staff there, who I have to say were just, they bent over backwards to accommodate me. And for any listener that is interested in historical cases, please make a trip to Tucson and go to the James McDonald Archives. There is a plethora of historic UFO information in the form of reports, handwritten notes. I have copies of handwritten notes by Dr. James McDonald, and more specifically, hundreds of hours of audio recordings, which the University of Arizona digitized from old reel to reels. And these are some of the classic names from the classic cases from the 40s and 50s and 60s. And I plan on going back there if time permits at some point just to research other cases. But I went there with the knowledge that James McDonald had investigated this case and came away with about 20 to 30 pages of documentation. Now, in the original newspaper article that is often quoted, there were roughly 12 to 13 witnesses mentioned. And those are the same witnesses, again, that you'll find time and time again quoted when people want to put it on a blog or on a website. I have, in addition to those people, 17 additional witnesses that Dr. James McDonald tracked down and interviewed, and we have their testimony to add to the rough dozen of the initial witnesses documented in the newspaper. And what that does is it helps us paint a much broader tapestry of what was taking place. Now, that's some additional information that the audience will hear. In addition, I went through, with the assistance of the University of New Mexico, which I've forged a very good relationship with, and there's another little mention that I'll say at the end as well, tying back to the teaser I mentioned earlier regarding UNM, but they were very interested in my research into this case. In fact, they weren't even aware of this historical event until I mentioned it, but they worked directly with me, the Southwest Special Collections Group there. In particular, I have to give a shout out to Mr. Mike Kelly, who was the director at the time. He just retired after the first of the year, but he was extremely instrumental in sitting there with me for hours going through microfilm. And what we found were not only the Farmington Daily Times, we found other newspapers in New Mexico from the week, preceding week and following week, documenting not only the Farmington wave, which occurred over those 3 days, we had sightings building up in other parts of New Mexico leading up to the famous 3 days. And then we started to realize there was a much broader wave of sightings that stretched out into Colorado. And then I followed the evidence where it led me. I continued to basically expand my search. And in point of fact, while a wave of sightings was occurring over New Mexico and Texas, and we'll talk about some of those cases as well at the conference, they were also having sightings in Mexico City and Monterrey, Mexico. So what occurred in Farmington was the tip of the iceberg. There was a wave of UFO activity. And by wave, I mean multiple objects being seen in broad daylight, some even tracked on radar, which is an important point to bring up, but being reported throughout the Southwest over a roughly 30-day period. And of course, Farmington now, we're realizing, was just one aspect of that. One of the details, and people can say, well, UFOs were being reported all over the place. But in point of fact, one of the sightings occurred in a small little township called Eunice, New Mexico, which is, if you think Roswell's out in the middle of nowhere, you go further southeast and Eunice is tucked away even further out from Roswell. There was an initial report early that week of a couple that saw a glowing red flying saucer moving slowly, heading from the west to the east, that then turned abruptly and shot north at an incredible rate of speed. Now, what's interesting about that was prior to the Farmington wave. During the course of all these reports during the Farmington wave, people typically described flotillas, fleets, organizations, echelon formation of gray or silver flying saucers. But interspersed with all of these reports, witnesses were describing, well, yes, there was the formation of those flying saucers, but there was that red leader. There was that red UFO that was leading them. Now, we had a report in Eunice of a red object. A few days later, we had it reported over Farmington. The same day in Tucumcari, New Mexico, which I just drove through 2 days ago on business, in Tucumcari, New Mexico, the same day, which was a Friday, which was March 17th, they had a sighting of UFOs and there was a red leader reported. So not only do we have reports of UFOs, but there are characteristics, specifically this red leader, that people were describing throughout the state.
Wow.
It's a very detailed series of events that took place. And in fact, and this is what's very interesting, all of this activity occurring, and by the way, we also had sightings over Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there was a sighting reported, and I'll show the audience. I have all the documentation to share with the audience. We have declassified documents through Air Force Project Blue Book files. There is an air intelligence report that talks about a sighting at Kirtland Air Force Base here in Albuquerque by 3 to 4 tech sergeants and a captain that were out on the tarmac that saw these two UFOs tumbling and rolling until they disappeared to the east-northeast over the Sandia Mountains. Now, what's interesting about that is when you look at the data, and we're going to do a deep dive in the lecture on this. We're going to lay it all out and let the audience decide. If you look at the tally report for the month of March in 1950, as far as the Air Force is concerned, there were no official UFO sightings that took place. But once I did the deeper dive, that's where I found this air intelligence report. And the same time that they were seeing these UFOs over Kirtland Air Force Base, they were having sightings in Farmington, and they were having sightings in Tucumcari, New Mexico.
So how can they say there weren't any sightings?
Well, and it gets better. Now,
that's a whole other subject. We won't even go there.
No, but this adds to one more layer of lunacy, as I like to call it, regarding the government official explanation. They have no official tally of UFO sightings that month. Yet, Dr. Donald Menzel, who was a famous debunker in the 50s for the Air Force, he was a physicist, a Harvard physicist, he came up with the explanation in years later, well, the sightings over Farmington, that can be explained away as a naval high-altitude skyhook research balloon that was launched at White Sands, New Mexico. The balloon ascended to about 60,000 feet, and it just happened to be over Farmington at the time, where due to the pressure and due to the cold, the plastic shattered, and what people saw were little bits of shiny plastic floating in the wind.
Sure.
I was recently asked by local media if I accepted that explanation. I said, if it was one day of sightings for a short period of time, I could be willing to concede people saw little shiny things up there and may have misconstrued those as flying saucers. But one, how do we explain 3 days of sightings in Farmington proper? Then how do we explain all these other sightings? And how do shiny bits of plastic account for the fact that you have this large red leader that people were very distinct saying it was a large red object? And people were very clear, and some of these were military pilots, by the way, from World War II, that said that these things were flying in a tight formation. And when one moved, they all moved together, almost like the Blue Angels. And so we have reports of that. And then something I decided to do, well, before I go there, let me just say, in James McDonald's files, he contacted a gentleman in an ONI, Office of Naval Investigation, or ONR, Office of Naval Research, and he contacted this gentleman, and I have all of his handwritten notes, which the audience will see. This gentleman's name was Dombrowski. Dombrowski did an exhaustive search of ONR records, and there were no Skyhook balloon launches in the month of March. The closest one he could find was launched in Minnesota and terminated over Michigan. So we have no official documentation to support that there were even a Skyhook balloon there, but I decided to take it one step further. Something that at the time in the late 60s, James McDonald didn't have easy access to, I decided to go ahead and look at the climatic weather data. And where was the wind direction and what were the wind speeds for these given times correlated to the sightings? There was no rhyme or reason. These objects in most cases were flying counter to the wind flow at those days and at those times.
Yeah, because you kept saying they were going west to east.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in many cases...
And wind directions should have gone west. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. So, and in fact, one of those particular instances we're going to talk about, because of the roughly 12 names, witness names, mentioned in the newspaper from March 18th, 1950, I tried to track down all of these witnesses by name. It took me about a year or so to try to track these individuals down. I spoke to some sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters of the individuals, but due to the passage of time, you can appreciate most of these people had passed on. I found one gentleman mentioned in the newspaper that's the last surviving eyewitness, and he's 91 years old. Still sharp as a tack. He's a very successful business owner. I don't think I can say his name publicly here, but I do believe I'll have permission to mention his name at the conference during my lecture. But very successful businessman. I've actually developed a very good rapport with him, and I plan on getting a video deposition, getting him on videotape. But for the conference, I'll have clips of the audio interview I did with him, so witnesses will be able to hear firsthand from an actual eyewitness that's still alive. But in his particular case, he was able to provide photos of the building he was standing in front of from 1950, a photo of this gas station. He was a young man working at a gas station at the time. I have the photo of the gas station that you'll be able to see, that the conference attendees will be able to see, and you'll be able to hear him relay in detail his sighting that occurred while he was standing right there that we see in the picture. But in that particular case, the objects were moving against the wind in that particular case. And I might add, some people will say, well, he's 91 years old, his memory's failing. In the James McDonald archives, after I had interviewed him, I went down to Tucson. I found an interview from the late 60s that James McDonald did with him. And I was able to play my recorded interview and James McDonald's recorded interview. And I am here to tell you, and I hope I am this sharp when I'm his age, every detail was the same. There was consistency in his reporting from the late 60s to 2015, my interview from last year.
Wow. Wow. And I'm impressed with your research. Detail and level of research. That's fantastic.
There's a lot of cases that have been investigated, but I like to take a deep dive. I want to get down to details. And there are a lot of details in this case. And a lot of people have said, you know, that's such an old case. Why are you resurrecting that? And again, I will ask the listeners, how many cases do you know where hundreds of objects were seen by thousands of eyewitnesses in broad daylight for three whole days? Now, something that people will say, well, were there any photos taken? And this is another element we're going to talk about in my presentation at the conference. There's a famous photo that has circulated, purported to be from Farmington, of the objects. It's a whole detailed story, which we'll talk about at the conference. I don't mean to tease the listeners right now, but there's just too much detail to go into, and there's a lot of visual elements. But I've been able to track down an original copy of this photo that has circulated from 1950, news service wire from London. I will be bringing the original photo that people can see along with an enlargement, and we're going to do some detailed analysis of this. And I'm still in the process of researching the background, but there's some very interesting elements to this photo that I think the audience and your listeners would be interested to hear about in greater detail. So we have government documents, we have newspaper accounts, we have Dr. James McDonald. I have a recorded interview with one of the witnesses. We'll talk about the photo. We also will hear from another eyewitness posthumously. This witness passed away a decade or so ago, but he was one of the primary witnesses quoted in the newspaper from 1950. And he actually had some of the best visual descriptions, which again were corroborated by other eyewitnesses as well. But in this particular case, and I've got an interesting little personal story to tell about this, he had one of the best descriptions, but when I went through the James McDonald material, I realized he had detailed notes of interviews with this gentleman because he had afforded one of the best sightings during this time period. And I was going through the audio recordings, and lo and behold, not only did I have the interview notes, but I have the audio recordings of interviews with this man from the late 60s. And I incorporated that into my presentation. So again, the audience will be able to hear from this eyewitness in his own words, you know, from the 1960s when it was recorded. But what was really interesting and made me feel really gratified, I had reached out to his grandson initially trying to see if, one, his grandfather was still alive, which he wasn't. But when I told him I had recordings of his grandfather being interviewed from the late 60s, to my surprise, when I gave my lecture here in Albuquerque, which again got a lot of media attention at the time, as I came to this point in my presentation, I said, and I want to thank his grandson for providing these photos of him, because I want to have a photo, a face to the voice, and your audience will be able to see this in Eureka Springs. And I said, by any chance, I said, you know, his first name's Mike. I said, is Mike in the audience? And I see this hand go up in the back of the room. I had texted him, emailed him, talked to him. I had never met him. I said, well, Mike, it's nice to finally meet you. And he continues to say, Dave, it's nice to meet you as well. By the way, my uncle, the brother of my father, is sitting right here. So I had two family members. And in fact, after I played the interview, his son said, Dave, you played that interview. I remember sitting in the living room with my father when he was having that conversation with Dr. McDonald.
Oh, how cool.
So it was really neat to kind of have that personal memory, that personal tie to, you know, their father and grandfather. And they've been very instrumental in helping me and assisting me with details in my research. And as you can see, I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg, but this is the material I've been amassing. And I already started working on the outline and preliminary data, but I will be looking at writing a second book, and it will be specifically on this case. And it will not only look at Farmington, it'll look at the Mexico sightings, it'll look at the sightings throughout the Southwest, incorporating all of this data. I've already gotten the okay verbally. I will also get written confirmation from the University of Arizona to use Dr. McDonald's data to incorporate into the book. And, you know, I think your listeners can appreciate there is a lot of data here, and we're just barely touching on the surface. But I feel it warrants a detailed investigation, a detailed write-up. And I just say, you know, shame on the UFO community, including myself, for letting this case lie there for so many years without giving it what I believe is the attention that it deserves.
No, I think it needed to wait for you. Because look how passionate you are about this. This is so exciting. It needed you.
Well, it's been a labor of love, and it's just the details. And that's something else that, again, we don't have time to go into, but I will be addressing this in detail. The descriptions of the objects, the maneuverability, the variations in formations and when these objects were coming in and moving over the city of Farmington. There is a rich history there. In fact, I will share this with the audience. One particular sighting involved a spotting scope or small telescope used to observe one of the particular objects. Now, in the newspaper article, and in fact, all of the newspaper articles, there was never a reference to this, but in Dr. James McDonald's notes, I have details concerning this and the individual and her husband who had observed this. And she was the only one that I've been able to come across that had an aided view, in other words, using some type of device other than the naked eye to observe this. Mm-hmm. And what she described was a cigar-shaped object with vertical panels or windows. So that certainly takes it outside the realm of bits of plastic, you know, from a ruptured skyhook balloon when we're talking about that. And then we had other maneuverability described by some of the other witnesses in James McDonald's notes, where objects were moving like a corkscrew and then stopping, hovering, and then shooting straight up. I mean, highly anomalous behavior for aircraft then, or for that matter today. And
it's
interesting. And you look at the similarities of the reports from New Mexico, Texas, Mexico City. Something significant was going on in 1950. And of course, the UFO activity has continued today. But there was something about March 1950 that seemed like it really suddenly, you know, hit a crescendo.
Absolutely. Now, before the time goes out, you had an announcement you wanted to make. I also wanted to correlate. I think it's interesting that you're talking about this article was on March 18th. Well, what is today's March 18th? I think that's interesting, the coincidental time that you're on the show today.
That is an interesting point that you make. And one other government what perfect timing. We couldn't have timed this any better. One other government explanation was instead of 3 days, they alluded to the fact, well, these sightings only occurred on one day, and that just so happened to be St. Patrick's Day. And I think you can read where they were going with that.
Oh, yeah.
But
okay. You said you had a special announcement you wanted to make, and we have 3 minutes left.
I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. We'll talk more at the conference about this. But working with the University of New Mexico and them being very instrumental, I had the director of the Southwest Special Collections Group and the chief archivist come to my home. I wanted them to see the level of research I was doing. And again, I have a massive UFO collection here. I have original 1897 airship newspaper reports. I mean, just to give you a flavor of how old some of this material is, I approached them while they were here and I asked them, would you be interested in this material, in preserving it within an academic setting at the library at UNM to be preserved for future generations and scholars and researchers? Unequivocally, they wanted the material. So we entered into a legal agreement. And again, I'm talking Lou Farish's material that I have here. I have other researchers' material besides all the material I've collected in 25 years. All of this material, if anything ever happens to me, will go to the University of New Mexico, where they will be preserving it in temperature, humidity-controlled environment in a secured facility for the general public, all interested parties, to come and do their own research, much like I did with James McDonald's collection at the University of Arizona. And the one important thing I like to mention is when they take a collection, it's in the contract, it's for perpetuity. So 50 years, 60 years, 100 years from now, the material that I've been sitting on, the research material that I've been working with, will be preserved for future generations. And I think I'm honored to be able to say that. I'm going to make the announcement at the Eureka Springs Conference. I think it's fitting at Lou's conference to be able to make that announcement, to let Lou know, you know, he's on another plane, but to let Lou know that his material will be preserved for perpetuity.
Wow.
I'm very proud to be able to say that, and I'm happy that UNM found value in this.
Absolutely. That is so wow. Well, David, how can people find you if they want to get in touch with you?
my publisher and my readers for the last few years have been pressuring me to get a website, which I haven't had time to do, but I finally do have an infancy website up and running. It's www.davidmarler, M-A-R-L-E-R, UFO.com. DavidMarler, UFO.com. And on that website, over the next year or so, I have a team of volunteers that are working to scan a lot of this old material and take a lot of audio recordings from reel-to-reel and cassette and convert it to MP3. I've actually thrown a few on there already for the listeners that would like to go there, some very rare recordings I had regarding various cases. But eventually, we want to try to digitize the majority of this, and it'll be uploaded to that website, along with my research on Farmington and my triangular UFO research.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for
being here tonight. I'm anxiously waiting for the conference. I feel like a kid on Christmas waiting to open my presents. I can't wait to to be down there again and see new faces, see some familiar faces, and like you said at the beginning, Julia, it's a magical place. It really is.
It is. Yes. Yes. Well, thank you so much.
And thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for being with us. And we'll see you actually in 2 weeks. So good night, everyone. We love you.